Matthew 17:14-17:20, Mark 9:14-9:24, 11:12-11:14, and 11:20-11:24. The 15th talk in a series on prayer was presented by Ron Julian on April 18, 1999 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1999. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
As probably many of you know, we've been talking about prayer for a long time, for a number of weeks. I'm getting towards the end of what I have to say about that. We've been looking at a number of passages. Today, I want to take on what seems to me to be one of the hardest of the passages that we look at that talk about prayer in the Bible, because in this passage or series of passages, what seems to be the case is that Jesus is telling us that we can have anything we want. If we just believe that we're going to get it, we'll get it. And that sounds great at first. As I think back on my life and some of the things that I thought were so essential that I wanted to happen that turned out to be not such a good idea, I'm not so sure that it is as good as it sounds, that God would give me everything I want, because I've wanted some pretty stupid things along the way. So let's talk about these passages. Today is going to be sort of emphasizing the interpretive question that we find in these passages, and I don't really know how else to do it. These are passages that I've been thinking about a long time. My thinking on them is just sort of coming together, in that I feel for the first time that maybe I have something of a handle on what's going on in them, so I'll try to explain it to you. I don't know how good I'm going to be at doing that, because I'm just sort of putting this together. But that means it's all the more important that you take the opportunity to ask questions at the end and make sure that I'm being clear in what I'm saying. To start with, I don't want to start with the most difficult of those passages, but I want to start with a couple of related passages that will help us, I think, sort this out. Let's start first in Matthew chapter 17, starting in verse 14. So in Matthew 17, we read, "And when they came to the multitude, a man came up to him, falling on his knees before him, and saying, 'Lord, have mercy on my son, for he is a lunatic and is very ill, for he often falls into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, and they could not cure him.' And Jesus answered and said, 'O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him here to me.' And Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once. Then the disciples came to Jesus privately and said, 'Why could we not cast it out?' And he said to them, 'Because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, "Move from here to there," and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you.'" I want to stop right there. Some versions go on to have the line, "But this kind does not go out except by prayer and fasting." We'll talk about that. It's a textual question as to whether that verse is actually there in the text or not. Okay, just a couple of things I want to comment in this passage that will be helpful to us. Jesus says this sort of surprising thing. The man comes and tells Jesus, "Here, my son has this big problem, and I brought him to your disciples, and they couldn't cast this demon out." And Jesus' response is not, Well, of course not. I mean, they're mere men. What do you expect them to do with a problem like this? Or he doesn't say to them, well, they're pretty good in some situations, but this is an extra specially difficult one, and so you can't expect too much of them. He says, oh, unbelieving and perverted generation, how long will I be with you? Seeming to imply that there's something very wrong about this situation, that the man brings the boy to the disciples and the disciples can't cast him out. It's going to be very important for us to get a handle on what sort of thing Jesus means by an unbelieving generation. What kind of unbelief is he responding to here? What is it? He seems to be suggesting that in this situation there is a blameworthy lack of faith. Well, what does he mean? It's going to be very important because I think the issue raised in this passage, and especially in the passage that we're going to go on to look at the end, is one of the places where we in the church face a choice and we very often go the wrong way. And as I said before, very often we see the issue in these passages as being essentially, look, if I had enough faith, I could do anything. Anything that I put my hand to, anything that I wanted to have happen, could happen. Now, I know that Jack has used this example in another sort of setting to talk about another aspect of theology, but it's such a great example because it is very, very apt in the kind of situation we're talking about. So I invite you all to think back to the movie The Empire Strikes Back, episode 2 of the Star Wars trilogy. Luke is on the planet Dagobah, I think, is that where he is? And he's being trained by Yoda to become a Jedi master. And Luke attempts, through the power of the Force, to raise this spaceship up out of a swamp. And he's got his hand on here, and it starts to come up, and then it sinks back down into the thing. And Yoda essentially charges him with a lack of faith. You doubted in this situation. And Luke says, well, that's impossible. I mean, his response is, you know, of course I doubted, because nobody could do that. So Yoda turns around and does the little thing and raises it up out of the swamp. Well, it's very clear in that situation that the idea is that the Force is available to do anything you want if you believe that it will happen. And the key is, how strongly do you believe that it will happen? If it enters into your mind to question that this is going to happen, then it won't. But if you can keep your mind pure and clear and think, I can do this, I can do this, I can do this, you know, the little train that could, then it will happen. That's what faith is. And it's really important for us to understand that that's an option out there, because that's what our culture thinks faith is. If you ever hear, you know, celebrities talking about their faith, a lot of times what it really comes down to is you've got to have faith. You've got to believe that this is going to happen. You know, we're playing the football game and we're behind, but I have faith. Meaning I believe that we can overcome this obstacle and win the game. A player in that situation, if they do win the game, will often even attribute it to God. It was my faith in God that won this game. And then we sort of stop and ask the question, well, didn't anybody on the other team have faith in God? What if you're playing a team that also has faith in God? Is it the score goes to the, like, the more believers on this team, they'll win? Or is it the strength of my faith that will win the game? I believed harder than you believed. I mean, it raises those kinds of questions, because faith is being pictured as this kind of power. And the purer and stronger the power is, the more powerful, the more effective it is, the more it can accomplish in the world. We have a tendency to bring that mindset to passages like this. What I would like to argue is that that's not the issue in this passage, nor in the other passage that we're going to look at. That's not what we're talking about. Well, let's see if I can try to show you a little bit what we are talking about. Notice what Jesus says to the disciples afterwards. Why is it that we couldn't cast this out? And what he says to them is, because of the littleness of your faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith as a mustard seed, you shall say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it shall move, and nothing shall be impossible to you. Now, it's possible that Jesus could be saying, all you have to do is believe a little bit that something's going to happen, and it will. But I would argue that the evidence of the Bible suggests that that's not the way prayer works. It's not the way that it worked for Jesus. It's not the way it worked for Paul. Paul tells the story about how he kept asking God to remove the thorn in the flesh, and God basically said no. Notice how in the examples of Jesus praying in the garden, Paul praying for the thorn in the flesh to be removed, Paul praying he is greatly desirous of going to Rome, we saw. And he's praying to God that he could go to Rome and help the disciples there. But when he describes it, he talks about himself as having prayed and prayed and prayed, and it hasn't happened yet, and he is hoping that at last, by the will of God, he might come to them. His attitude is not, if I just believe that it will happen, it will happen. His attitude is the attitude of a supplicant, one who is coming to God and saying, this is what I want. But in all of those situations, there is very much an awareness of the question, what does God want? It is not the case that I can just say, I want it and I'll get it. Prayer is pictured as going to a God who has a mind of his own, who has a will of his own, and making my request. In the case in the Garden of Gethsemane, the will of God was that Jesus go to the cross, even though he asked to pass it by. It was the will of God that Paul keep the thorn in the flesh, even though he wanted it removed. And for a period of time, it was the will of God that Paul not go to Rome, even though that's what he wanted to do. And then ultimately he did go, as we've talked about before. He went in chains. So, when we come to passages like this, it seems to me that it is important for us to distinguish between two issues. There is the ability of God to do miraculous things, and there is the will of God. You understand the distinction that I'm talking about. One question that I can have in my mind is there a God, and does he have the power to do what I am asking him to do? The other question is, will he do it? Is he willing to do the thing that I am asking him to do? I would argue that the mistake we make in these passages when we come to this language about how there's nothing that will be impossible is that we mistake these passages as teaching us about the will of God when in fact what they're teaching us about is the ability of God. That is, what we're learning in these passages is that God is able to do even surprising and miraculous things. And I shouldn't be surprised and I shouldn't doubt that he can do those kinds of things. But these passages are not telling me that he is willing to do anything that I tell him to do. These passages are not saying anything I get in my head, I could ask God and if I believe it will happen, it will happen. What if I get it in my head to believe that God will do something evil? What if I get it in my head to believe that God is going to bring curses on your life? I've decided I don't like you, and I want God to bring misery and suffering and cast you into hell forever. And I believe it will happen. Is this a promise that you know, are you at my mercy because I've got the power? I believed it, so it's going to happen? I would argue, of course not. That's not what the Bible is saying. In the passages that we're looking at, the issue is God able to do what I am asking him to do? Now, when it's in a situation that I know that it is the will of God to do the thing I'm asking, then the only question in terms of my belief is he able? Do I really think that he's there and that he is capable of doing what I'm asking? That's what I would argue is the issue in these passages. So, now, let's come back to what he said. If you have faith, and in other passages it becomes clear, the issue of the mustard seed is the issue of its size. The mustard seed is a very comparatively small seed. So if you had a faith that was just little, imagine the littlest seed in the garden. If you had a faith that was that small, you could do something really big, he's saying. A faith this small could take this huge mountain and move it from here to there. Well, what's the point of this analogy? What is it that he's saying? Isn't it, in fact, to emphasize the difference between the size of the faith required versus the size of the miraculous event that you're asking about? Why is it that it's just this teeny little bit of faith that could move mountains? It's because the moving of mountains is not dependent on faith as this power. I am not a magician. It is not that I have summoned up this huge quantity of supernatural faith that I have thrown at the mountain and caused it to move. Faith is faith in someone. I believe God. God exists, and he is able to do what I am asking him to do. All I have to do, Jesus is saying, all it takes is some faith. Believe that God does what he says he will do. That's what's required. So, I would argue in this passage, if he's saying that all it takes is the faith the size of a mustard seed, that's his answer to the disciples as to why nothing happened. Well, what was the situation? The situation was that the disciples didn't have faith at all. They really weren't looking to God to do anything in this particular situation. Now, why would I say that? Let me take you to the parallel passage in Mark and compare what Jesus says there, and then I think I can explain what I mean. We're in Mark 9. This is essentially the same account with some with a little more detail and something that we don't see in the other passage. Again, in verse 14 of Mark 9, "And when they came back to the disciples, they saw a large crowd around them and some scribes arguing with them. And immediately, when the entire crowd saw him, they were amazed and began running up to greet him. And he asked them, 'What are you discussing with them?' And one of the crowd answered him, 'Teacher, I brought you my son, possessed with a spirit which makes him mute. And whenever it seizes him, it dashes him to the ground, and he foams at the mouth and grinds his teeth and stiffens out. And I told your disciples to cast it out, and they could not do it.' And he answered them and said, 'O unbelieving generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you? Bring him to me.' And they brought the boy to him. And when he saw him, immediately the spirit threw him into a convulsion, and falling to the ground, he began rolling about and foaming at the mouth. And he asked his father, 'How long has this been happening to him?' And he said, 'From childhood, and it has often thrown him both into the fire and into the water to destroy him. But if you can do anything, take pity on us and help us.' And Jesus said to him, 'If you can, all things are possible to him who believes.' Immediately the boy's father cried out and began saying, 'I do believe, help my unbelief.'" Okay, now let me just stop right there because I want to make a comment about that. Here again we have that language, all things are possible to him who believes. Now once again, we could take that language as saying, belief is a kind of power that can make anything happen that you want. You know, the Star Wars kind of model. All things are possible to him who believes might be saying, and I think we often take it as saying because we're used to thinking about it this way, as saying, if you just believe it will happen, you can do anything. Anything can happen. Meaning that the only thing that's standing between you and making something happen that you want is that you believe that it will happen. And this is Jesus' advice. He's coming along and saying, you want this to happen? You know, anything that you want to have happen can happen, but you've got to believe. How many self-help gurus of our age take that sort of spin on this language? They'll quote Jesus Jesus says this, as if what he was saying is, the only thing that's stopping you from unlocking your potential and making everything happen is you've got to believe that you can do it. You've got to believe that this thing is going to come about. Again, I think that's the wrong spin on what Jesus is saying. That's not what he's getting at. Because the issue in these passages is a human being looking at the seemingly unsolvable task and feeling despair. The issue is not, I don't feel like I can do anything about it. I'm right in thinking that. I can't do anything about it. But where did God go in this equation? Here is a man standing before the Messiah, the one who claims to be the servant from God himself. He knows what his disciples are about. He knows who this guy is and what's going on. He, at a minimum, is a servant of God who is going around and doing miracles. And yet the man says, when he comes to Jesus, if you can do anything, you know, please take care of him. And Jesus picks up on that. He quotes it back to him. If you can, what do you mean by that? Let's talk for a minute. What do you mean, if I can? All things are possible to him who believes. He's not saying that faith is a power that can cause things to happen. The issue, again, is faith in God. When you say, if I can, do you mean you don't really know that there's a God, whether or not there's a God? You don't know whether I'm, in fact, his servant? You don't know whether God is able to do such a thing? Is that what you mean when you say, if you can? Jesus is confronting him with the question of faith. Here I am, the Messiah, the servant of God. What do you think about that? Not, can you get it in your head to think, the spirit will go away, the demon will go away, I can make this go away if I just have the power. No, he's saying, who do you think you're dealing with here? Am I a quack? Or am I the servant of God? And is God capable of doing what you're asking here? That's what Jesus is confronting him with. Do you believe or not? Not do you believe that you have the power to cast out a demon, but do you believe in God? Do you believe that I'm from God and that I can do what I say I can do? And the man answers in what has to be one of the most personally significant verses in the Bible. One of the verses I picked up on right away. I believe, help my unbelief. I identified with that sentiment very strongly the first time I ever heard it. Because that's exactly, I think, all of us recognize that there's this tension. That we believe, and yet there's always this pressure on us. There's always that temptation not to believe. Our faith is not all that strong. What I understand to be happening here is the man has understood the challenge that Jesus has made to him and is basically responding, look, okay, yes, since you challenge me to choose here, I recognize what you're saying. I ought to believe in God. I ought to believe that God can do such a thing, and I do. But I also recognize that if you can do anything has its roots in a pretty weak faith on my part. So help me. Yes, I'm not rejecting your claim. I'm not saying I don't believe that God can do this and that God is working in you. I believe it, but I'm weak in my faith. Help me. So, again, what I'm trying to get across is there's a choice that we face as to what the issue is in these statements. And I would argue that the issue is my belief in the reality of God, my belief in the power of God, my belief that God does what he says he will do, and so on. Even in the face of what seem to me to be obstacles that I cannot overcome. If you're going to talk about moving a mountain, I can't move mountains. But all it takes is the simplest belief on my part that God can, for me to be a recipient of his promises, for him to do what it is he said he would do. Now again, I want to make it clear as we're going along, and this is going to be especially true in the next passage. We've got to make this distinction between his willingness and his ability. In this situation, Jesus is clearly involved in a ministry of the miraculous. His disciples have been sent out, commissioned by him, to do the same thing. And they already have done such things. They have healed the sick. They have cast out demons already. So it's not as if that it would be unreasonable or presumptuous to assume that God would respond to their request to do it in this situation. This is clearly on God's agenda. God is in the business at this point in history of validating the ministry of the Messiah through the miraculous. So, for the willingness of God is not really an issue in this passage. But what's at stake is the ability of God. Have I lost sight of who it is I'm trusting in and what it is I believe he can do? Notice what Jesus says in this passage in response to them. In this passage, we don't see that part where he talks about the moving the mountain and the mustard seed. We see another statement. He says, "This sort only comes out with prayer." And again, some passages have "and fasting," but that's a textual issue. And I would argue that the fasting in this case really does not make any sense, that it is an addition that has been put in, I think, because people were trying to figure out, what does he mean? He must mean that it's some extraordinary kind of prayer that is involved. Normal demons, you can just cast them out, but this kind, you really have to fast and go through a whole set of religious exercises to make sure that this kind of demon goes away. Well, maybe you can stop and think about it. That doesn't seem very likely in this situation, because that's not what Jesus did. He did not fast and go through this big set of religious exercises because of how difficult it was to cast this demon out. He just said, "Get out of there," and it was gone. Should we think, well, it's because he's God and the disciples aren't, so they have to do something different? That's not the picture we see in the New Testament. Jesus keeps saying them, "What I do, you can do." And I would argue that the picture of Jesus doing the miraculous in the New Testament is not because he's God. He is a man trusting the Father in the same way that anyone else would. He is praying that the transcendent God overall would respond to his request and do this thing. He's not doing any different than the disciples did when they cast out demons or healed the sick. He's relying on the power of God as a man, as a human being. Yes, he is God become man, but he was a real human being who prayed to the Father just the way the rest of us do. So, when we come right down to it here, Jesus' response to them is very simple. He says, "Why couldn't you cast it out?" In one passage we see, he says, "Because of the littleness of your faith." In this passage, we see the rest of his response, which is, "This kind only comes out with prayer." Well, in the first passage, it seemed to imply that the disciples didn't have faith even the size of a mustard seed in this situation. And if he's telling them this kind only comes out with prayer, that seems to imply that the disciples weren't praying. So what were they doing? Well, I don't know exactly. We don't know exactly what's going on in the passage. But doesn't it seem likely in this situation? Can't you imagine that the disciples, having sort of had a taste of the healing the sick and seeing what Jesus is doing, here's this situation. They've kind of gotten in the habit of thinking, okay, we're kind of like magicians. We go and we say this and it happens, and we say this and it happens, and they come up against a really scary situation and they sort of go away, and nothing happens. They've totally forgotten what it is that they're doing. They have lost track of what's going on here. They feel like ineffectual magicians and they don't know what to do. Instead of thinking of themselves as simple human beings who are asking God to do a miraculous thing in the life of this boy. So what Jesus' response is, when we put it all together, is in essence, you guys faced a scary, difficult situation, tried a little hand-waving, it didn't work, and then totally lost your perspective. You're totally freaked out. Oh no, we can't do it. It doesn't work. You're not thinking about what this is about. You don't have any power. You're not magicians. You're counting on the power of God. Can God do this thing? Even this scary thing, this kid who's had this for years and thrown into the fire and all of that stuff, can God do that? Yeah, he can. All you've got to do is believe it. The issue that you face is not, do I have the power to cast out demons? The issue you face is, do I believe that there's a God and that he can do what he says he can do? That's what I think is at stake. It's a simple issue of faith. Remember, the willingness of God to do this is not at question in this passage, because this is something that Jesus has already explained to them. This is a part of the ministry that you and I are carrying out. We are healing the sick. We are casting out demons as a sign that the power of God is with us. So there's no question about the willingness of God to do it. But what they have forgotten about is the ability of God to do it. Now, having said that, I want to take you to the toughest passage. This sort of helps to set us up for the passage that we want to look at. This is in Mark chapter 11. I'm going to look at verses 12 through 14, and then I'm going to skip a little and go to verse 20. Okay? So we're in Mark 11, verse 12. And on the next day, when they had departed from Bethany, he became hungry. And seeing at a distance a fig tree in leaf, he went to see if perhaps he would find anything on it. And when he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. And he answered and said to it, "May no one ever eat fruit from you again." And his disciples were listening. Okay, now we jump to verse 20. And as they were passing by in the morning, they saw the fig tree withered from the roots up. And being reminded, Peter said to him, "Rabbi, behold, the fig tree which you cursed has withered." And Jesus answered, saying to them, "Have faith in God. Truly I say to you, whoever says to this mountain, 'Be taken up and cast into the sea,' and does not doubt in his heart, but believes that what he says is going to happen, it shall be granted him. Therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they shall be granted you." And whenever, okay, I'm going to stop right there. He goes on to say another thing about prayer. And maybe we'll talk about that in a second. Now, you take that language. All things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them and they shall be granted to you. This is like the A number one, hands down, most difficult verse to talk about for somebody who thinks that prayer is what I'm saying it is. Okay? Rightly so, as we've talked in sessions past, people have raised their hand and said, "Hey, Ron, what about this?" So, what's going on here? Well, let's just ask the question right up front. If you want to argue that the Bible is inconsistent, that we've got one thing over here and another thing over here, and none of it hangs together and makes any sense, then I can't really say anything to you. All I can say is it is possible that Jesus means what I'm saying he doesn't mean, and that he is contradicting the picture that we see in other parts of the Bible. That's possible, but I don't think it is. If that's not the case, then what is going on here? I think, again, we have to make this distinction. This is where it's crucial in a passage like this, between the issue of the ability of God and the willingness of God to do something. Jesus is not saying here. See, we come to this passage and we think, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them and they shall be granted to you. It sounds like he's answering that question that I always wanted the answer to. how do I get what I want? And the answer is, believe you're going to get it, and you'll get it. But that's not the issue in this passage, is it? He's not talking to the disciples about how to get what you want. He's responding to their surprise that the fig tree has withered. The day before, he says, may no one get figs from you again, and the next day they look and the tree has withered up. This was a miracle, and we could talk about that miracle. I think he does it not out of a fit of... I think we're not to picture Jesus going along, you know, he walks and he stumbles over a rock and he blasts it. Stupid rock, get out of my way. And I mean, you know, he bumps into somebody in the crowd and he, you know, they fall into a pile of dust. That'll show you getting in my way. And here's a fig tree and he goes to get figs and there's no figs. He says, oh man, blast it and that'll show you. I think it's intended to be at this time when he has come to Jerusalem to declare himself as the Messiah, that this is intended to be an enacted parable. That the idea is, here's a tree that's supposed to be giving figs, and yet I, the one looking for the figs, it bore no fruit. And so what good is it if it bears no fruit? I'll curse it. And we're talking about some of the other kinds of parables that Jesus tells about the vineyard owner who goes to collect the produce from the vineyard, but there is none, or the people running it won't give it to him, or something like that. That's what this miracle is about. It's not just a fit of pique on his part. This is something that we're supposed to stop and think about. Why did he do this? But what the disciples are responding to in the situation immediately is, it worked. I mean, you cursed it and it withered and shriveled up. How'd you do that? I mean, that's amazing that happened. Well, what's his response? Have faith in God. Jesus is very audacious in the way he responds to... I mean, if Jesus were to come into our midst right now, come walking in here and do some miraculous miracle, all of us here, I mean, and this is not to our credit, all of us here would be greatly surprised. We go, whoa! Well, and his response would be, well, so what did you expect? I mean, we're talking about God. This is God. Can't God do anything he wants to do? We're so caught up in the mundane, in the day-to-day, the way the things normally go, that it is very easy for us to forget that the way things normally go only go that way because God has put the world together in such a way that it goes that way. And at any moment, he can decide, I'm going to have it go different. Because this is the Creator. This is the one who is in charge of everything. So the disciples are surprised by what's happened, and his response is, have faith in God. That's the key. Have faith in God. That's the issue. It's not, hey, isn't that neat? You guys can have anything you want, just like I can. I got mad at the tree, I blasted it. You get mad at somebody, you can blast them. You want something, you can have it. Because if you just believe, you'll get it. Well, but that's not what he says. That's not what the issue is. The issue is, can such things be that a miraculous thing like that would happen? And the answer is yes, it can be. So when he says, when you're asking, you shouldn't doubt, and that all things you pray and ask, believe that you have received them. Now, again, I recognize, I'm not stupid, I recognize that it does sound like what he's saying is anything that I might believe in, if I believe that it will happen, I'll get it. I would argue that in all the passages that we encounter this sort of thing, as I've been saying, we have to distinguish between the willingness of God to do it and the ability of God to do it. Now, in the old days, I used to think about this passage this way. Jesus is talking to his disciples. He's preparing them for the ministry that they are about to have. They are going to be charged with going and doing the very same kinds of miracles that he's doing. And so here, the willingness of God is not at issue because the things that they are going to ask for, the miraculous things that they're going to ask for, they're going to get because that's what God has charged them to do. And so If the willingness of God is not an issue, what he's assuring them of here and reminding them of is the ability of God. And what you need to do, what is appropriate for you, is to believe that God will do what he said he will do in the situation. I'm looking at this passage a little differently now, and I hope I can be clear in where the difference is. I think this is just a general statement that he is making. It's as suitable and appropriate to me as it was to the disciples. But the issue is when he says, "Therefore I say to you, all things for which you pray and ask, believe that you have received them, and they shall be granted you." As much as it might sound like he's saying anything you want, I'm thinking now that what he talks about, anything you ask for, pray and ask for, he's assuming that the issue of the willingness of God is taken care of. I can't believe in a meaningful believing way. I could be a heathen, I could be a pagan and believe, you know, I blast you and you're going to get blasted. I could believe that if I'm a pagan. But if I'm a Christian and I believe in the God that is revealed in the Bible, then I can't believe that. I can't take to heart and say, I believe that you're going to get blasted when I do that. Because why would I believe that? Is there anything in the Bible that would tell me that anytime I want to blast somebody, God will do it? Is there anything in the Bible that says, if I want something that is contrary to the will of God, I'll get it anyway? No, that's not the picture that the Bible paints. So the kind of belief that he's talking about is the sort of mature belief that a person could have who understands the God he's dealing with. But if the issue I'm dealing with, what he's saying is it doesn't matter how big it is. It can be moving mountains. It can be cursing fig trees. It can be the salvation of your evil soul that is mired in sin. It can be freedom from death, which has its grip on every one of us. It doesn't matter how big or miraculous it is. God is capable of doing it. And so if I have reason to believe that I can call on God to do something, then I should believe it. And it is only those who believe, ultimately, who will receive. That's a very biblical notion. If I turn away and say, I don't really think that God is there, or I don't think he's interested, I don't believe in the promises of God, then I'm not going to receive anything. But Jesus is saying to them, you shouldn't think about your prayers either as this shot in the dark, this, oh well, you know, what the heck. Toss one out there, maybe something will happen. He's saying, have faith in God. Who are you dealing with? You're dealing with the one who has put the whole world together. So should you believe that he is going to do what you have asked him to do on the assumption that you have asked him something that is according to his will, as we saw in 1 John? I can have confidence that God will do what I ask when I am asking according to his will. If I have reason to believe in the willingness of God, then what reason would I have to doubt the ability of God? That's what Jesus is getting at. How can I know that? Partly because the issue in these contexts is not you can get what you want, but is God able? And partly I know that by putting together what the rest of the Bible says. The Bible talks about the ability of God to do things, and I should believe that. It talks about his promises, the things that he has said he will do, and I should believe them because he has promised. And it also paints a picture of those things that he has not promised to do, which I ask him, and I wait to see his will. That's the picture of prayer that the Bible paints. I just can't believe that Jesus is contradicting that here. So, in the end, then, I think the lesson that we're supposed to take away from passages like this is Jesus thinks that you and I have every reason to believe in the ability of God to do whatever needs to be done. It may seem like it would be real zippy to have the power to curse fig trees and heal people of diseases, and there is something spectacular about that, but not nearly as spectacular as what God has promised to do for those who put their trust in Him. Cursing a fig tree is nothing compared to bringing the light into my heart, freeing me from a faithlessness, rescuing me from hell, saving me from death, redeeming me from sin. Those are miraculous things. I mean, check it out. Look at your life. You can't do it. You cannot free your heart from the entanglement of sin. You can't rescue yourself from death. You can't do it. You just try. It's not going to happen. What do I need? I need a miracle from God. I need Him to forgive me. I need Him to rescue me from sin, to rescue me from death, to bring me into life. That's what I need. That's the miracle that I cannot bring about. When I call out to Him to do that, what should my attitude be? My attitude should be, have faith in God. I know He is willing because He has made that clear in the Bible. I know He is able because He has demonstrated that as well. So I ought to believe Him. That's, in the end, what these passages come down to. Being demonstrated specifically in these little sign miracles that Jesus does, but the application extends to anything, any of my interaction with God. Okay, I don't know if I've been clear or not, but let's take some time to ask questions, make comments, laugh in my face. I can take it. I can't take it, but go ahead anyway. Logan.
Okay, the disciples encountered this kid with a demon and couldn't do anything about it. Up to that point, they had been able to do things about other things.
Yes.
Now, your point was not that this was a bigger thing, but they had forgotten.
I think so. I think that's what makes the most sense in this situation. Unless we're to assume, I mean, because what he is saying, he's talking about the littleness of their faith and that it requires prayer to get this out. So something has changed in this situation. If we want to argue that somehow there are healings and demons that you can take care of that don't require faith and that don't require prayer, but now we've come across a demon that does require faith and does require prayer, I guess I'd be willing to go that way, although no, I wouldn't, because that doesn't make any sense. So if it's not that this one requires faith and the others didn't, then the only other thing that makes sense to me is that somehow in this situation, maybe because it was a bigger deal, I mean, this was like the first really big, scary thing that they came across, that they, in the face of the bigness and the scariness of what they were dealing with, they forgot about God. All they could think about was their own, how are we going to handle this? What are we going to do about this? To me, that makes the most sense out of the situation. Now, you have another proposal?
Well, on the surface, that doesn't seem to be much different than what Luke Skywalker encountered. He was okay with the little stuff, but when Yoda handed him something big, he freaked.
Right. But, see, I'm not saying that faith in God is different than what you see in the Star Wars movies in every regard, because it isn't. The question is, what's being challenged, though, in that spot? The picture in the Star Wars thing is, I mean, this is why I emphasize, Luke started to do it. He got the thing partway up because he had the power, but somewhere along the line, he lost his nerve and thought, oh, this is too big, I can't do it. Well, the lesson that Jesus is trying to teach his disciples is a different one. I don't think that's what, you know, the demon started to come out and then they lost their nerve and it went back in or something like that. I mean, the question is God big enough to do this? And when he talks about the mustard seed faith, he's distinguishing between a picture that somehow, that would make sense to us if we have that sort of magician kind of model. The bigness of the job corresponds to the bigness of the power that I've got. I've got this huge faith that has taken on, you know, not everybody could do this, but I can do this. That kind of model. What he's saying is, no, the hugest task imaginable, and I would say, this is not his language, but I would say, what is a bigger task than rescuing me from my guilt and my sin and death? I mean, this is huge. Does that require a huge, unwavering, miraculous power mindset? This is, I'm grabbing a hold of this salvation and pulling it to myself through the strength of my will or something like that? No. I take my puny little faith and cry out to God, help. And I get saved from sin and death. And that's, I think, what he's getting at, is that all it takes is, it's not the size of the faith, it's, you know, it's binary. Is it on or not? You got it or no? That's the question. And that this was really intended to be kind of an enacted sort of lesson for the disciples, I think, in a sense, that they would come to see, they could think back about their lack of faith in this situation and ask themselves, well, what was going on with that? Why didn't we remember that God is the one who does this stuff and that he's very capable of doing this? That's how I would see the lesson. I don't know if I'm explaining the distinction very well. I would argue there is an analogy between the fact that the bigger the challenge out there, the more likely I am to freak out, to feel alone and forget that God is the one who is to handle it. I think that's true. So in that sense, it's like kind of like Luke's thing. But what I'm trying to distinguish is that idea that somehow it is the strength of my inner power, resolve, and belief that causes big things to happen. Why could Yoda do it and Luke couldn't? Because Luke, if we talk about faith in regard to the Force, Luke had faith the size of a mustard seed, but Yoda had faith the size of a mountain. And that's why Yoda could do it and Luke couldn't. But that's what I'm saying. That's what Jesus is saying is, it's not your power. Just trust in God. And he's big enough to do whatever the job is. That's the distinction I'm trying to make. Yeah.
I'm a bit confused the difference between faith and prayer. Why the use of prayer here and in this circumstance? It seems like prayer should always be a part of faith. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I don't think there is a distinction. When he says this kind only comes out by prayer, I think he could have said, that's why that fits together with what he said, if you only had faith the size of a mustard seed. I mean, prayer, faith, it's the same thing. I'm calling on God because I believe he's there, and I believe that he will do what he said he would do. So yeah, it's two different ways of describing the same phenomenon. If I believe that God is there and that he does what he says he will do, then I go to him. And if I don't, then I don't. We see the same thing. One of the first passages months ago that I talked about is the passage of the unjust judge, where Luke introduces that by saying, Jesus told this parable to show that they should pray at all times and not lose heart. And the picture there, I argued, is one of facing into the question in the face of the fact that the deepest things that I have called out to God for have not yet happened. I mean, I'm looking to him for a life that has not yet come. I'm looking to him to bring justice to the world, and it hasn't happened yet. Like the widow who kept going back to the judge and the answer was no, what sort of a response am I going to have to that? And what what he was trying to teach them was to keep on praying. In other words, not to lose faith, not to stop believing that God will do what he has promised to do, because that's what he goes on to say. Think about who you're dealing with. This is God. Will he not answer the cries of his people? He says he will. So keep praying, or keep having faith. It's the same thing. It's just prayer is faith expressed at those times when the pressure is on and I call out to God. So I think there really isn't all that distinction, much distinction in a way. Yeah, Paul?
Getting on Logan's part about where you were having a problem with some miracles require faith and some don't. What about the verse where Christ says, many will come to me and say, Lord, we did all these miracles in your name, but I'll say that I don't know you. Does that imply a similar type of distinction?
Well, that's a very good question. I don't know. I've never known exactly what to do with that, because there are several possibilities in the end, I think. One is that the people who are making that claim believe themselves to be miracle workers in the name of God, but that in fact it's not really true. Now, that's not an implausible thing, because I think we could look around and see examples of people who have pushed the claim that they are miracle workers and have many people believing them, and yet I think upon examination it is not true. So it may be that the claim that these people are making is as false as their claim to be people who belong to Jesus in the first place, in which case that would not imply the distinction that we were talking about there. Another possibility is that this gets really complicated. Let's see if I can do this in a way that's going to make sense. I'm kind of thinking on my feet here, but there is a meaningful distinction, in a sense, between two kinds of faith, and here's what I mean. If we were to go and look at 1 Corinthians 13, I may have talked about this passage already, I can't remember. Paul concludes that by saying, essentially, it doesn't matter what spiritual gift you have in this life. What matters is faith, hope, and love. Now, what he means by faith in that situation clearly means he's talking about saving faith, that kind of faith in the promises of God that leads to a hope for my future and brings about a commitment to the values of God and love and those sorts of things. Those are the important things. That's what you've got to have, he argues in that passage. Earlier in the chapter, he has a list of things, gifts that you could have from God that are not worthy to be compared with faith, hope, and love as what everybody needs to have. Well, in the list, one of the things that he lists there is the faith to move mountains. Well, he says it doesn't matter whether you have the faith to move mountains. All you need is faith, hope, and love. Well, wait a minute. We've got faith over here, we've got faith over here. What are you getting at? I'm understanding what he's doing there. I mean, he's in 1 Corinthians, he's dealing with a list of these miraculous gifts, healing and various things that God is doing in particular individuals, and saying this person has this gift and this person has this gift. And one person might have the gift of moving mountains, essentially. That is, I have been called to exercise a miraculous ministry. I am believing God to move mountains, and the mountains are moving, so to speak. You know, I'm healing, or you know, whatever it is it might be. But he's saying you could have all of that stuff. You could be a miracle worker, and God, his Spirit, could be working all kinds of miraculous things through you, but if you don't have faith, hope, and love, you got nothing. He's arguing. So we can see the same sort of distinction when Paul talks about himself. He's a miracle worker. He's an apostle and doing miraculous things and has been given the gospel and pronouncing it, and yet he still says, I have the personal responsibility to embrace this message by faith myself, lest after preaching to others, I should be disqualified myself. Again, sort of implying a distinction between God's individual working, you know, I'm going to work miracles through that person and I'm going to do this through this person. God could do such a thing, and that isn't necessarily related to that personal hearing the gospel and believing that it is true. Not just trusting God to do miracles, because it's kind of fun to do miracles, but trusting God when the pressure is on, trusting God when he doesn't take the thorn out of my flesh, trusting God with my own salvation, that's a different question. So I suppose it's possible with passages like that that it might imply that there is a difference between my personal investment in the belief that God is good and that he will save me as he has promised, and a kind of miracle belief. You know, God is there and these miracles will happen. I suppose it's possible that something like that could be implied. None of those passages actually says that it's true that that happens on a regular basis. It just sort of implies the theoretical possibility that it could be true. That's about the best that I can do with that. That's a little bit different than the kind of distinction we were talking about. I think all that really needs to be true in this situation is that something happens that shakes the disciples out of their complacency, and in that they fall back on their own sense of inadequacy instead of remembering the God that they're dealing with. It seems that that's all that's really required. Larry?
This is going to kind of address part of what you're saying, that it's going to go in a different direction. So, yeah.
Okay.
I was looking at the passage, your first passage in Matthew 17, and noticing the verse that says, Jesus answered and said, "O unbelieving and perverted generation, how long shall I be with you? How long shall I put up with you?" He's kind of hard on the disciples there, yes. And he's saying that they've twisted this thing. It's mm-hmm. perverted. It's, mm-hmm. and which I think goes with what you're saying.
Right.
My question is, the next thing he says is, "Bring him here to me," and I presume that's the boy, right. The epileptic. Then he says, "And Jesus rebuked him, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured at once." Mm-hmm. So Jesus rebuked him. Is it him the demon, or is him the boy? And because it goes on to say that the demon came out of him.
Right.
What do you think?
Well, let me just check something here before I answer that question.
I don't have my Greek with me, so.
Right, and well, neither do I. Yeah, I think it has to be the demon, because in the parallel passage, it says he rebuked the unclean spirit, saying to it, "You deaf and dumb spirit, I command you, come out of him and do not enter him again."
Okay.
So,
yep.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yes?
Just out of curiosity, why would the unclean spirit be in gender neutral and the demon be gender male?
I'm not sure what you mean. The word spirit is neuter, is that what you mean?
Yeah, I mean, his questions got me thinking about whether he actually rebuked the boy or the disciple or the father or someone in the immediate vicinity.
Right. I'm just going by the English here. I don't remember. We'd have to look at the Greek to see what the genders are involved. That kind of stuff, a lot of times those are translation decisions that the translators make. The Greek pronouns don't always so easily map onto our... It's hard because all words in Greek have gender. So, you know, I could talk about something that is obviously an object, but it is masculine or it is feminine. Well, when I translate it, even though it's masculine, I don't translate it him, because it doesn't make any sense in English. That's not the way we use gender in English. So it gets a little tricky. I'd have to look at it to see. Maybe we should stop here. We've gone a little over an hour. Thanks.